the week of February 10th, 2013, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 181, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Now, you are probably buried, Michael, and by buried, I don't mean in dirt, I mean in snow.
Oh, no, it's almost all melted away. It's fine. New York, we got less than a foot. It's fine. Just
really?
A snowstorm, no big deal.
You know, I thought maybe because you would have been shoveling snow all weekend, I was going to go easy on you, but I have a bone to pick with you.
What?
Last night, I'm sitting there working on the show notes, prepping for today's show, and I have avoided Twitter. I have avoided email because the Grammys are not broadcast live on the West Coast. So I didn't know who won the awards. Purposefully, I was staying away from news reports and everything. And there you are in the show notes in Google Docs telling me who won.
Sorry.
But in any case, I learned a lot, actually, watching the Grammys last night.
Well, who are we going to talk about that with?
Well, we actually are going to... Wow, you didn't want to hear my jokes, huh?
Oh, they're coming now?
Well, yeah. No?
I thought... What'd you learn on the Grammys?
Well, I learned that Taylor Swift and I, we are... You know, it really is over. We're just never getting back together again.
So who are we going to talk about the Grammys with?
Come on, no? No, well,
you need new writers.
Look, I'm not going to be
David Wilde.
That's true, and you know what? Even though Taylor and I are over, I'm not going to be a lonely boy because I will wait for her.
You actually could write for the Grammys.
No, these are all the songs. You get it?
I get it. That's what they love doing.
You know, there's a reason I don't work for Leno, Letterman, or Kimmel. You know that, right?
Oh, you could write for Kimmel. Trust me.
Oh, yes.
Oh, snap. I took down Jimmy Kimmel.
Well, as you mentioned on today's show, we are going to be talking about the Grammys with David Wilde, who was one of the writers on last night's telecast, unlike myself, as you can well imagine. And as if that's not enough, he writes the Grammys, but he is also busy writing for Rolling Stone, where he's a contributing editor, and he is the author of He Is, I Say, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love Neil Diamond, as well as a co-writer with Brad Paisley on Diary of a Player. We're also going to be talking about the BAFTA Awards, which were held in the UK over the weekend, and really they made it official. Argo truly is the frontrunner for Best Picture now, and the only interesting Oscar races remaining are for, like, Best Supporting Actor and Best Actress.
You're in Los Angeles?
I am in Los Angeles, yes.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, you can. Hold on.
Are you on the set of a remake of Texas Chainsaw Massacre?
No, I am not. Although this is the Chainsaw Orchestra, which did not get a chance to play at last night's Grammys. So they.
What is that?
That is the city of Los Angeles cutting down trees outside our studio. So if you can hear a chainsaw faintly in the background, that's what that is.
Are they dying or diseased? Why are they cutting them down?
Let me call the mayor. I have no idea.
They're just cutting down trees for fun?
Yeah, well, no, because they said, oh, you're recording now? Okay, let us know exactly when you press record. We'll make sure to turn on the chainsaws.
All right. So if they hear a buzzing sound in the background, it's not you going psycho. It's just the city of LA randomly cutting down trees for no good reason.
Right. And this would be a really bad time for me to have a run-in with a serial killer that uses chainsaws.
Yeah. Oh, well, actually, is that nerve-wracking in Los Angeles? Because you do have that cop running around. I mean, you're not a cop, obviously, but it's kind of scary and weird.
Yes, although, you know, he's in a completely different part of Los Angeles.
It doesn't feel like it's near you at all, and he's targeting police, unfortunately, but so it just doesn't feel like some imminent threat.
Yeah, that's right, and not to talk about that subject, but I found it very odd. I got an email in my inbox over during this manhunt for this cop killer running around Los Angeles, and it was from the Hollywood Reporter, and it said, you know, cop killer
who will get the first movie deal.
Right, exactly. It was like all
oh, really?
About the entertainment ties to this manhunt, which
right.
was the big story of the day. And I thought, come on, you must be kidding me. But apparently in his manifesto, this crazy manifesto that he wrote, he references all of these celebrities.
Yikes. What else are we going to talk about on the show?
Well, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to you, Michael. Entertainment journalist extraordinaire, you're going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
I am, and the number one movie around the world is Melissa McCarthy and Jason Bateman's Identity Theft. It grossed $36 million around the world. It is essentially open only in North America. They'll open on like 100 screens overseas and made like $200,000 in some other part of the world. I don't know why they opened it on 200 screens in Scandinavia or something, but that's what they did. But this is a huge win. I mean, it was a big snowstorm of a weekend. Box office was meant to be depressed. And they think this movie might have hit $40 million if it hadn't been for the snowstorm. And so it's a really big opener. It's the fifth biggest R-rated comedy opening of all time, whatever. It's a successful opener, a big hit for Melissa McCarthy. I love Jason Bateman, but she's getting all the credit, and understandably so, coming off of Bridesmaids and her hit TV show and her Emmy wins. So there you go. Great news for Melissa McCarthy.
You know, we should mention that her television show is Mike and Molly. And that when you say whatever, you're really just saying whatever to all the qualifiers about, well, you know, number one rated R comedy in February on an odd weekend when it's snowing in Detroit.
Exactly. And number two around the world is Quentin Tarantino's Django Unchained. It grossed another $21 million worldwide. As we told you last week, it has now crossed the line. It is his biggest grossing film of all time in both North America and around the world. It's made $342 million to date. And I've been listening to the soundtrack over the weekend. I was deciding whether it would be on my best albums of the year list, and it didn't, but it's a fun soundtrack. It has a lot of dialogue from the movie, which had me laughing out loud as I walked down the street. And I thought, anyone who is offended by the dialogue of this movie should actually be offended by Gone with the Wind, not Django Unchained. Anyway,
nearly $350 million on its way to $1 billion. Not bad.
It's not going to hit a billion. But it's still pulling in money. It looks like it could hit $400 million, especially if it has some Oscar success. It'll certainly get close to that. And it cost $110, $120 million to make, I think. So that's a strong success story for his most expensive film to date. It cost $100 million, to be exact. So he's more than tripled the budget. That's great news. And it's another successful movie. He can write his own ticket for his next film. At number three in around the world, Hansel and Gretel, The Witch Hunters. That made $17 million worldwide. It's at $127 million to date. It still needs to make a lot more money overseas to become a solid success story. And number four is Warm Bodies, the zombie romance movie. It made $16 million. It had a pretty good hold. It dropped about 44%, which is somewhere in between a successful romantic comedy and a horror flick. A horror flick usually drops a lot more, but this got good enough reviews, I thought it might hold even better. But it's made $45 million to date. It's one more step towards Nicholas Holt becoming a star. He's got another big movie, of course, Jack the Giant Killer, opening soon. So that's good news for him.
And number five, you like Nicholas Holt, right?
Oh, I like him a lot. I think he's very talented.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I've liked him since Skins, the UK show that made him launched his success story. And number five is Lincoln. That grossed $12 million around the world. That's at $220 million and counting. Is that right? Yeah, it's just started really overseas, I guess. And number six is Les Mis. That's $11 million. It's at $359 million and counting. And number seven is a three-way tie. Three different movies made $10 million. The first one is the most interesting. The Bruce Willis, A Good Day to Die Hard. The latest Die Hard movie opened overseas, not hugely, but it opened and it did gangbuster business everywhere it opened. $10 million overseas.
But you know what? It is the final Die Hard movie of 2013.
That's probably true, unless they do a director's cut or something. Also tied for $10 million is Steven Soderbergh's Side Effects, which I've heard described as Hitchcockian. It's gotten some good reviews from fans of smart movies. It had a decent opening. It probably didn't cost a lot to make. And then there's Mama, the horror film, which had a strong business overseas. That's made $10 million. That's at $77 million and counting. So we can look for Die Hard to open really big when it opens here on, of course, Valentine's Day, because nothing says Happy Valentine's like blowing stuff up.
Well, you know, I think that Side Effects, you know, you said it's been described as Hitchcockian. I've heard it described as Steven Soderbergh's last movie.
Right. Does anyone believe that?
I don't.
I mean, I'm sure 3 years off, maybe 5 years, but there's not a chance in heck that he's not going to ever make another movie again.
I agree with you.
I just don't buy it. So, whatever. But he needs a break. Whatever. Enjoy. Whatever is the word of the day, by the way. At number 10, two movies tied at $8 million. Life of Pi, which is now $565 million. And Flight, the Denzel Washington movie, which is opening a little bit more overseas. That's at $128 million. At number 12, a three-way tie at $7 million. Silver Linings Playbook, again, all credit to the Weinsteins for doing a terrific job of marketing this movie. Zero Dark Thirty, which somehow, a movie about United States invading the country and killing Osama bin Laden. It's not as popular overseas as it is in America. That's at $100 million and counting. And Cocoa 2, which is a German film. It's a sequel to a hit comedy, which was sort of like Three Men and a Little Girl. Instead of Three Men and a Baby, it was about a man getting a kid who, you know, his daughter they didn't know he had. And now they've made a sequel because the first one made a lot of money. So that had a very strong opening in Germany. We can look for the English language remake any day now. At number 15 is Gangster Squad, $6 million. That's at $87 million and counting. Then The Impossible, which has done much better overseas than it did in North America. It's already fallen off the charts here. It's at $154 million worldwide. It made $5 million this weekend. And then an interesting story at number 17, a two-way tie at $3 million. Ted, which has been finally released in Japan and pulling in some money there. And Argo, which moved back up the charts, especially in North America, thanks to all the awards it's winning. It's at $195 million and counting.
Well, you know, you mentioned Zero Dark Thirty not playing well overseas. I heard this story, I want to say it was on Marketplace or one of the NPR shows, where they were talking to somebody who lives in Pakistan, and they were talking to her about whether she saw Zero Dark Thirty, and she said that as soon as it came out on December 25th in the U.S., she started checking her local DVD store, which is a store for pirated DVDs. And it took about 2 or 3 weeks, but then she was able to get the pirated DVD, which was an excellent copy of the film. And then she was able to watch it, and she could tell us all about, you know, the response that people in Pakistan were having.
Well, that piracy is an issue all over the world,
but they started talking about it. They did continue to refer to it as the pirated DVD, which she had paid a dollar for, but didn't talk about the fact that they, you know, this was a rampant practice in Pakistan.
Well, are you surprised that Pakistan doesn't have good theatrical distribution?
No, I'm not.
I hear the theatrical distribution in Afghanistan is terrible. The multiplexes really are not up to snuff. I mean, come on, Of course, there's no good, strong theatrical distribution in Pakistan.
Fine.
I mean, let's be realistic. If we're talking London, it would be shocking, but not in Pakistan, not in Afghanistan, not
right,
in Iraq.
I guess my reaction and response was they never once talked about it like, hey, you know, this is a pirated DVD. It's pirated.
You said they mentioned it every 5 seconds.
Well, they just continued to refer to it as that, but they never really went into the fact that it was
should
pirated.
Should they spit every time they say, hey, pirated DVD?
Yes.
What do you want them to do?
Spit, yeah, would be good. Spitting
all
would
right.
be fine.
Well, what do you, don't do a spit take, but what do you think of Parental Guidance? It has made $113 million worldwide. This is the comedy starring Billy Crystal and Bette Midler. It cost $25 million to make, but there's a big asterisk with that because Billy and Bette say, hey, the movie makes any money? We're making money.
It didn't make any money. Go away.
What about it did? It made four times its budget.
Yes, but of course it cost $25 million to make and another $25 million to market.
So now it's in the black.
Okay, so then it made
$113 million so far, yeah. So
okay.
Did they make?
So it made $3 million.
You don't think this is a success story for them?
No, not really.
They got it made. They got a couple million dollars. I'm sure they got a kicker once it hit $100 million worldwide or something like that.
I'm sure the writers and the director and both the actors and there's certain talent that will get bonuses that'll be like $100 million.
They all made $7 million. They all made seven figures.
Yeah.
And they made a movie. I mean, Billy Crystal can't expect to greenlight movies left and right.
No, especially so anytime he appears on TV, he tells everybody, you know, if you're younger than like 50, then, you know, ask your parents.
Right. But so isn't that a happy story?
I guess
everybody happy? They made the movie. Nobody lost money. Everybody made a little money. Everybody's happy.
I guess so. I would say it's a break even on this.
Anybody happy about, well, it is a break even at worst right now. What about Top Gun?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well,
now, Top Gun came out in theaters in North America, about 300 screens. It came out in IMAX 3D. Very exciting. They probably spent $6 or $8 or $10 million probably to convert it to 3D. Is that about right, Sperling?
Yeah, I would say I wouldn't be shocked. It's usually about $1,000 a minute.
Minute or second?
Sorry, you're right. Second.
Yeah, $1,000 a second. So that would mean for a 110-minute movie, about $6 million.
Right. Somewhere in there, yeah.
Right. So, but probably a little bit more than that still right now. $6 million sounds a little low.
Well, but then you have to market it.
Well, then you got to market it, of course. Yeah, so this movie came out, 300 screens. It grossed $1.9 million. And Hollywood Reporter had the nerve to say, quote, a respectable $1.9 million. Really? No.
Well, what was the per screen
average? That's a money losing $1.9 million.
What was the per screen average? Was $6,333. You know, that's actually a very good per screen average for what they did. Now, I would agree with you that
tomorrow nobody's going to see it. It's going to fall off the cliff.
Yeah,
it's not good because they had to spend money to open this movie, and they opened it on so few screens because they knew there was no demand. Nobody cares about seeing Top Gun in 3D. Everybody's running away from wasting money on this. Disney, Star, everybody. And this movie was, you know, supposed to set up the Top Gun sequel, which has fallen apart because, sadly, director Tony Scott killed himself. But this was going to, you know, the idea was you put Monsters, Inc. out on 3D and get people excited for the sequel, or rather prequel. In this case, you put out Top Gun and go, oh, my gosh, now we can't wait for the sequel. Well, what you're doing is telling people, oh, my gosh, nobody cares.
Right. Well, or, oh, my gosh, we could watch this at home, but without 3D. Hey, let's do that.
Right. It is an interesting movie, though. I mean, obviously, it was a huge hit. It made $350 million worldwide way back in the 80s when Tom Cruise was just a kid. Still one of his biggest hits of all time. And it was one of the very first films to be sell through on videotape. You know, in the old days, as you know, Sperling.
Oh, I know. Yes.
Movies came out on VHS. They cost $80 or $90.
They called that priced for rental is what they
priced for rental. They'd be available for rental for like a year. And then after a year, they'd sell off those copies cheap, or they'd lower the price. You could buy a new copy of a VHS tape for a movie that'd been out a year already on VHS and buy a copy eventually a year later. Then they said, hey, why spend all that time? Wait, let's sell it. Sell through right away. And so Top Gun was one of the first. It was, I think, $20, I think, for sell through, maybe $25. And it was immediately the best-selling VHS tape of all time just based on pre-orders. Never mind how much it sold after, you know, opening weekend. But it was a big hit on VHS, one of the leaders along with Disney and all their animated films into turning the video industry from a rental business to primarily a sell-through business. So it's a pretty significant film.
Yeah, I think that for Paramount, they were already halfway through, if not more, when Ridley Scott, not Ridley Scott, Tony Scott died. So they just decided, let's finish up the film. It's already half converted or more. They did what they had to do to get this film out and not take too much of a hit on it. I mean, $1.9 million.
Yes, but it was a bad idea to open it, period. It doesn't matter whether the sequel was coming out. People weren't going to flock to this because there's a sequel in the works. People weren't going to suddenly say, oh my God, I want to see this in 3D. I want to pay $20 to see this in 3D. This 30-year-old movie, because they're working on a sequel.
Yeah, especially
it was a bad business decision from the get-go.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that you're right. Deciding to spend $8, $9, $10 million on a film that's going to open to $1.9 million on only 300 screens. Yeah, that's a bad business model.
And the company that converted it, unfortunately, invested in the conversion because they wanted to make the product. They wanted the project to finish, and they actually invested their own money in getting this done because they saw it as, of course, encouraging Hollywood to convert more and more of their library into 3D. And
who was the company that did that? Was it Prime Focus?
It was on Hollywood in High Def website. They told me about that.
Okay.
So I forget the name of the company because it's some obscure 3D conversion company and I hate what they do. So, you know, I don't wish them well. Well, you know, I don't wish them poorly, but it was silly. The review on Hollywood in High Def, which focuses on Blu-ray and 3D, and they're huge cheerleaders. Like, oh, it looks great. Oh, my God, it's so cool. It's great. It's wonderful. It's so much better in 3D. But what about Argo? Do you think Argo would be improved in 3D?
I don't think so. I think that Argo's doing just fine all by itself. Over the weekend, it won Best Film over at the British Academy of Film and Television Awards, the BAFTAs. It also won Best Director for Ben Affleck, so that's probably the last big award he'll win. Of course, Best Actor was Daniel
Day-Lewis.
Well,
that's the last one eligible. There's none left. He's not nominated for the Oscars, so you make it sound like a slap.
No. Meaning, yes, exactly what you said. It's the last award he's nominated for.
There comes Leatherneck, or whatever he's called. Leatherface.
Leatherface, yes.
I can hear him coming. And the other awards seem to be fairly predictable. Best Actor, Daniel Day-Lewis. Best Supporting Actress, Anne Hathaway.
Right. Yeah. I mean, at this point, I would say that Argo is the front runner for Best Picture at the Academy Awards.
I disagree.
You're absolutely right. I would disagree too. Everybody's saying, gee,
Argo. You disagree with yourself?
No. Well, I'm reporting the news.
Ah.
So I'm reporting what others believe to be true.
Ah, those fools. Talk to me.
So I think you're absolutely correct in that Argo is it's a good movie. I like it. I enjoyed it. I don't think it's the front runner for the Oscar. I still think Lincoln has that tied up.
Because even though Argo has won everything else in sight?
Because it is more of an Academy movie. And the Academy does not like to follow in the footsteps of others. And since others, including the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, picked Argo. The BAFTAs picked Argo. Well, the Academy has to do something completely different. And it's not that kind of year where, you know, they're going to look silly for choosing a Lincoln or a Les Mis, which doesn't have a hope in you know what. So I think, you know, Lincoln still has a shot.
You really think that's how the voters work? They're like, uh-oh, Daniel Day-Lewis has won every award in sight. We better not give him Best Actor.
No, when it comes to Best Picture is what I'm referring to.
What are your examples? Are there a lot of examples of movies sweeping every other award in sight and then not winning the Oscar? They're like, no, we won't do it.
The year Crash won over Brokeback Mountain.
But that was not a year where there was a solid front runner. I mean, Brokeback hadn't won everything else, had it? Maybe it had.
I believe it did.
I thought that was a year where there was no clear front runner. This Argo has remarkably swept virtually everything. Kind of amazing.
I agree. And so who do you think is the front runner?
Lincoln.
Okay, then. So we are vehemently agreeing with one another.
What about the Grammy Awards?
What
Can anybody
Grammy
ever
Awards?
Agree on the Grammy Awards?
You know, I know just the guy to ask about that.
Sperling, you're driving me wild. Who is this guest?
Well, actually, you know, if you watched the Grammys last night, there was a point there where LL Cool J was talking about, you know, these different Twitter handles, and the second Twitter handle out of his mouth was @wildaboutmusic. And if you're not following that Twitter handle, you really are missing out, because that is the Twitter handle of David Wild, a contributing editor to Rolling Stone, of course, the author of numerous books, including He Is, I Say, which is a biography of Neil Diamond, and Diary of a Player, How My Musical Heroes Made a Guitar Out of Me, and he wrote that with Brad Paisley. And just because he's not busy enough, he also wrote the Grammys last night. David, thank you for joining us.
Hey, how are you doing?
We should be asking you.
I'm good. I'm tired but good.
How do you judge the success of the Grammys? Is it purely the ratings, or it's you wake up the next day? What's the first thought in your mind? You know, it's a great show because of the performances or the ratings, or is it feedback that you get? How do you judge?
Well, the ratings, I have to say, are, you know, the ratings have a way of waking you up either in a good mood or a bad mood. And in this case, we were really thrilled because, you know, frankly, you know, and other people, I think the first, you know, sort of articles we saw, Variety reporting, you know, second highest in so many years and whatever it is, 13, 25, whatever they're saying. You know, coming after last year, which was a unique event, we knew it wouldn't be last year, but the Grammys have been on this big upswing, and we just wanted to continue to be, you know, delivering the kind of experience that we've tried to over the last, you know, last decade. I think the show's gotten better and better. So I was already happy, but I'm thrilled that the ratings were also strong.
Yeah, I mean, just to let everybody know, 28 to 30 million people tuned in last night live to watch the Grammys from, you know, coast to coast here in the United States. Of course, the Grammys they're the music awards for, I guess the world, really.
Yeah, no, I think it's actually become increasingly global. I mean, one thing I liked about last night's show is we reflected that, I think, a little better than we usually do, you know, whether it was Ed Sheeran with Elton John, which was sort of a nice nod to a... you know, he's already a very big deal in England, and that was, I love that moment. And then having Juanes, who I don't think has ever performed, ever sang on the Grammy stage, trying to work in more moments that sort of reflect the world of music, because I do sense that the show has more and more become like, you know, it's been for a long time, but I feel it's increasing like the world's big music show.
It really is a phenomenal show. I mean, it's like one of the best concerts of the year every single year now.
Yeah, no, and last year was, you know, frankly, you know, forgetting about the impact of the Whitney Houston death and how that, I think, brought a lot of people just to see how we'd handle it. We also, you know, we had last year Springsteen and McCartney and all these sort of very veteran icons. And I think this year, you know, I was always, after like a show like last year, you always worry, but I was very, very happy. And I think Ken Ehrlich, you know, our executive producer and the whole team, I think we, you know, I'm very proud of the show, and I love working with LL Cool J. I've done the show for 12 years, I think, and I've only had a host, you know, a couple of times with Jon Stewart and once with Queen Latifah, but just it's great to settle into a great dynamic with Todd or LL, because he couldn't be a better guy to work with, and just, you know, so, and it helps me, because, I mean, this is going to sound pretentious, probably because it is pretentious, but you try to do, I think part of the success of the show is trying to get sort of set some themes and do a kind of, as much as you can in this kind of award show context, have a little bit of storytelling. And Todd allows us to do more of that. Like, I think he's not a comedian going out for a lot of jokes. So he is this voice of a passion for music. And that's kind of like what we try to make the whole show. It's, I mean, that's why you notice a lot of the, you know, presenters, not a lot of banter. There's more people performing into other performances. And I really love that. That's something that, you know, I just think as a music fan, I think we have a unique ability not to just be another award show.
Well, yeah, I mean, I noticed that LL Cool J came out and he introduced himself and explained that last year there, you know, was the tragic death of Whitney Houston less than 24 hours before the Grammys, and he had to change how he was going to introduce the show. And we talked about that on the day after last year's Grammy Awards show. And this year he came out, explained that, and then said, here's what I was going to say last year about the Grammys. And I thought, wait a second, David is... he's recycling material.
No, I wish it were all that easy, because the absolute truth is I said that after the show, and I probably said it on your show, that I wanted to get to that material because I thought it was important. And then we took a complete, no one knows this, we took another complete direction and thought about that for and worked on that a little bit. And then I think just, you know, recently decided, no, we have to say this stuff. We have to, I want to make this connection with the viewer. I want them to know, and the other musicians. So, you know, I can't say enough about him as a guy to work with. He's, you know, having a host means that you have less presenters, which is great for me, because you can get, you know, the good, the bad, and ugly with presenters. But, you know, Ella is very invested in the show emotionally and really cares about this and really wants to have it mean something. And honestly, I mean, he's hosted two of the best rated at Grammys ever. And that's, you know, because I think he really brings something to it.
Well, when you go to a wedding or friends say they were at a wedding, they say, oh, it was nice. And then you speak to somebody who's part of the wedding party. Then you say, you find out the drama and the excitement, the drunk uncle, the person who got angry and wouldn't do their part, or they showed up late. So behind the scenes, tell us, what was the big exciting behind the scenes drama of the show? There must have been some crisis or something that had to be put together at the last minute. What was the most tense or exciting part of the buildup to the Grammys?
Well, I mean, last year with Whitney, we had as much nervous tension as we've ever had. This year, we had a major, I don't want to say any too much, but there was one major sort of piece of equipment that, you know, to be used in a performance that failed or broke down.
I assume that it was Mumford and Sons, because that performance, they've performed their song really well, I Will Wait, terrifically a number of times, and they're very good live. And there was something off about their performance, whether it was the sound mix or they couldn't hear themselves. I don't know what happened. It wasn't a disaster, but it was notably not as good as you would expect from them.
Well, I wasn't them, but I'm actually sitting down. We have a meeting after the show this morning, to go through things. And I haven't seen the whole show, so I will go through it. But, so my vantage point in performances is odd, because I'm backstage, so I'm not hearing them like anyone else is. So I like to watch it on TV and see what everyone else is experiencing.
Yeah, because so you did have some equipment failure in one of the performances.
We have equipment failure. There's always drama. There's like, I mean, things you can't even believe go on, like, you know, Prince to come wanted a certain suite where he could, you know, that he would be in to watch the show. And then you find out that someone accidentally sold the suite or whatever. It's things like that. And you go, and, you know, you have to rewrite, you know, there's things, you know, presenters drop out, presenters come in, presenters. The hardest part is when you have multiple presenters and they don't agree on what they want to do. It's like it's always painful when you write something and someone, one loves it and the other doesn't. And then you know that what's going to happen is you're going to write another one and they'll switch places. It just happens all the time. But I have to say, this was not an especially difficult year. And people who you think, you know, might be difficult weren't. You know what I mean? Like the mood among presenters, I think the view of the show is sort of changing, and like as the music industry evolves into a smaller thing, I think there's a sense of like people do kind of treasure this opportunity. If they don't love it emotionally like we do, they just see it's a very important part of marketing music. So everyone seems pretty happy to be there. I mean, really, you know, they're like, it was like a party for me backstage. It was like, you know, John Mayer and Katy Perry. Everyone was very nice and pleasant and fun. And, yeah.
Well, that has. I'm sorry, Sperling. That's kind of a fascinating thought, because if you look at the charts today, people are lucky to go platinum, and that's. I mean, even the biggest acts are lucky to go platinum. They're not going double platinum. That's for a 99% of the acts now. And even, you know, 3 years ago, Carrie Underwood would sell 5 million copies, and now she's going gold or platinum. And that's all throughout the industry. It's not a slur on her. And it's possible you're actually seeing that blowback where the acts are like, gee, this show is a really, we're not going to sell 3 million copies just by coming out of bed in the morning. And this is a great platform and a great opportunity. It's made them a little, not more humble, but just a little more appreciative of the Grammys or appreciative of being able to reach a wide audience.
Yeah, no, there's artists like Bruno Mars who, you know, you can sort of just see his ambition. He really, I loved the performance, the whole medley thing with the Marley tribute. He's sort of like, hey, thank you very much for coming, have a good evening or whatever. It's like he was Dean Martin and it was his variety show. It's like, I think he's great. I thought that number was fantastic. And then you have someone like Carrie Underwood who, you know, that's a very ambitious sort of technologically groundbreaking performance. And she still sang the hell out of it. So I don't, you know, she amazes me.
Well, we should point out that performance, the Carrie Underwood performance that you were saying, I'm not a big country fan necessarily. I mean, I don't dislike it. I just, you know, I don't really know a lot of the music. And I was, you know, I may have been working on, say, notes for a particular show that we do once a week during that right. song. But all of a sudden, out of the corner of my eye, I see Carrie Underwood on stage in this beautiful dress. The lights are kind of down low. And her dress all of a sudden lit up like Disneyland. And I guess you were projecting stuff on it, and it was one projection after another. It was fantastic, I thought.
Yeah, no, I think the process is called mapping. I'm not exactly sure because I'm just a writer, but I thought it was stunning. And you know, I work with Carrie a lot because of the CMAs, and every once in a while, and you know, she was in such a good mood when she left the stage. She actually went to hug me, and I'm sorry, she gave me a kiss, which. Frankly, you know, that means she must have been over the moon to sort of, you know, be that agreeable because of the restraining order and all.
Well, and she had to perform rooted to the spot because of the technology. She was in this dress and she's belting out two numbers of different sort of rhythm, first Blown Away and then two black Cadillacs. And she couldn't move. So she had to do all that in a sort of an unusual way for a performer where she literally was rooted to the spot so that it would work. Frank Ocean had right. sort of the same thing. Yeah, he had a cool little...
There was a little play, you know, where she could move the slightest bit, but I guess she asked the guy who came up with that and who was working on it, I said, so there's no way you could have her move too? He said, no, if we were, you know, bringing this on an international tour, we could probably have the time, we could make more projectors, we could make it so she'd have more leeway. I think it was just, this is like something sort of fresh and, of course, not easy. But I just thought that number was stunning.
Yeah, I mean, there were butterflies coming off of her dress at one point and flying throughout the arena. It was fantastic.
Yeah, I thought it was great. And it's a gutsy thing to do, you know, because it's the kind of thing that if it didn't work, you know, and the butterflies were all over her face or something, it could have gone wrong, but it was great.
I thought the Bruno Mars medley with Sting and the Marley family was terrific. That was a highlight of the show. But you look at Carrie Underwood, and then you look at another highlight, Kelly Clarkson, who sang a tribute to Patti Page and Carole King. She did Tennessee Waltz and You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman, and she did a great job. And there was also Jennifer Hudson. You know, there were other acts there connected to American Idol. If you wonder why American Idol still matters, they are the only show that has created these artists, and they're a big part of the musical universe for the past decade now.
Yeah, we didn't have Jennifer this year, but she obviously was there last year. And yeah, we had Keith Urban, who's now on Idol. But I personally think, I'm not saying there's any sort of sense of competition, but I tend to be more interested in talent than talent shows. It's just, you know, I'm glad there are talent shows. I'm glad the world gave us Carrie Underwood and Kelly Clarkson, who I think is amazing who sang her, you know, heart out. But yeah, no, I do like, one thing I do like about the Grammys is the opposite of the talent show. When you get the, like, veterans who just have such great touch, like Elton John singing both times. I just loved hearing him do something other than his hits, because I've, being a fan, I've seen him in concert 500 times doing his hits. But hearing him do the A-Team with Ed, and hearing the tribute to Levon he did, you know, as part of that ensemble that was T-Bone Burnett helped us put together. I just think it was, I love, and yeah, and singing with Bruno. Because the funny thing is,
great.
That song Locked Out of Heaven, I, which I like very much. It's like, I said, like, man, this is a little like Sting. It's also, and the Police, it's also a little bit like Romantics talking in your sleep. It's like, it's like the most 80s song I've ever heard, I think.
Well, do acts like the Lumineers, a kind of an independent act that broke this over the past year, do they understand, I mean, is when they're going through rehearsals, which I assume that you get to see at least some of, do they
know,
know the significance of what they are undertaking, that how important this moment is to their lives and career?
Yeah, generally speaking, I get the sense they do. And most of these people realize it's not, and again, it doesn't make everyone's career explode, but I've seen it happen, you know, and it happens very often.
It's an opportunity, right? It doesn't happen automatically.
Like, for instance, that guy Miguel who sang yesterday, you know, I think a lot of people don't know him, and I think a lot more people do. In fact, he got the best commercial in the world because Kelly Clarkson said, Miguel, I have no idea who you are, but I have to do a duet with you. I think that's like the best kind of advertising, you know, any artist could have.
On the opposite end, you had Hunter Hayes, who is a country artist, and he's very good looking. He's cute. He could have wide appeal way beyond country. And his big song Wanted is a song that crossed over to a degree. You know, he's very much has a potential good future. He had like a 30-second spot to do an intro to Carrie Underwood's big number. It was Carrie Underwood he introduced, right? And
yes.
Unfortunately, I think he was amped up and he overperformed his number, maybe because of the tight spot he had, or he just was too nervous or amped up about that performance. And I think he lost an opportunity. And that's kind of the excitement of the Grammys, too. You know, you don't know if someone's going to not deliver. That can happen. And, you know, when that happens, that's kind of good television as well.
Yeah, you know, I think I was running around during the performance, but I'll go look at that. But in rehearsal, I thought he was wonderful. I mean, he's a great guy. He's actually he's been her opening act, you know, for a long time. So we did that last year with, you know, having the Civil War's intro, Taylor Swift. And I kind of like that tradition. And I remember pitching them a joke, which was, we'd like to thank all our opening acts. And I think I mentioned Springsteen, and they made it. We'd like to thank our opening act, especially that guy McCartney from Liverpool. And I'm waiting for the second record from the Civil Wars. Hopefully that'll be soon.
Now, well, do you think there'll be a second record? Because there is some talk that they kind of have broken up and they're not touring. And I saw you sent out a tweet yesterday about the Civil Wars, that they were there in the Staples Center. I'm hoping that they cut another record.
I think there is music coming. I believe there is. And I think T-Bone Burnett actually told me that there was music coming.
Oh, that's good news. Now you just talked about writing lines for presenters. Probably one of the best lines last night was, I don't know who wrote it, but Katy Perry came out and talked about her eyelash line and that she, you know, she may never have been nominated.
Her copy was a collaboration between me and Katy and John Mayer. And John Mayer, I believe, threw the Bon Iver joke.
Oh, that was the kicker. That put it over the top.
Which was great. So that was, I think I wrote it originally as, and for all of, you know, to all the winners, you know, I'm not as congratulations. And if you don't win, don't worry. I wasn't, you know, I never got this award and I'm making a good living or something like that. And then it got better and better with them getting involved. And so they brought a lot to it. And that's one of my favorite moments in the show too. I love, you know, John has a very good sense of humor. Sometimes gets himself in trouble with it.
Yes, very much so.
He seems like in a great place. And they seemed, both of them couldn't have been nicer yesterday. It was so great. You know, they seemed, yeah, I won't say anyone that, but yeah.
Well, Adele had a nice little one-liner as well. And I thought, well, I don't know whether that was off the cuff or whether David was helping her
write
that.
We, I wrote one one-liner, and then she said, she suggested, which I, again, that's like the sort of conversation you have. And she, by the way, I had never met her when she was at the Grammys before. Never, because she'd always performed, but not presented. And she couldn't be nicer. But she had to dare to go to the pregnancy thing. If I had, she just is kind of a warm, funny person. So I thought that was very real and very funny. And I think we, you know, got a great moment from her.
Yeah, I mean, for those who didn't hear it, basically she said, you know, look, people who win Album of the Year, they go on to have great careers, they do big tours, and, you know, then there are people like me who just get knocked up.
Yes, exactly.
Do you have you read any of the critical reaction yet? There were a couple bizarre pieces, one in the New York Times and one in the Hollywood Reporter. The New York Times, for example, talked about Adele winning again. She's the first woman since Barbara Streisand to win back-to-back Best Pop Solo Performance. So it doesn't happen a lot. And yet they acted like this was the most insane, ridiculous thing in the world. And they said, do Grammy voters receive a shock every time they vote for someone other than Adele? I'm like, it's only happened once. You know, they did it last year for her big album, and they gave her one more this year. It's not like they've done yeah, 8 years in a row giving Adele awards.
I have not read much of anything. I was pretty wiped out, and then we went to this meeting. I heard from someone that there was a crazy story in the New York Times. I have not read it. There was a profile of Kenner, like, that I was quoted in, like, the day before the show that I read. But no, I haven't. And you know what? I guess maybe I won't seek that out.
Well, it wouldn't be upsetting because it's not about the show. He just complains that they just complain about bizarre things. Like, they name acts who didn't get to perform, like Drake and Justin Bieber and Kanye West.
But
like, well, they just performed last
year.
Justin
Bieber wasn't nominated. And Drake, I can only tell you he was offered opportunities to perform. What's funny is that TV critics always get that wrong. They always assume that as a producer or writer or whatever, you can make anyone do anything. And it's like, no, you can't. People have their own issues.
Well, I would say the one way you could make the awards better was if you got to choose who actually won. That's my only complaint.
Yes. I don't write the winners in the envelopes. Sadly, I don't have that power. And the thing about Adele, just to answer that New York Times point, what people don't realize, there's like a afterglow effect with a really big record. Like if I remember Steve Winwood years ago or Santana or Bonnie Raitt, there's this often because the singles come out over the course of a year, you get that sort of, if they've gotten this huge momentum, often there's a couple more nominations or wins the next year just because the tracks from that album keep coming out.
Yeah, of course. And it was one of the biggest sweeps of all time when she won her Grammys last year. And one of the complaints was, oh, well, nobody swept. They handed out awards to everyone like it was ribbons at a summer camp swim meet. You're like, well,
right.
Now you're complaining that it wasn't predictable.
Well, let me ask you this. When they're trying to figure out like how to do certain performances, when somebody says, hey, we should make it rain inside on Fun, do you say, hey, you know what? Maybe not, because those instruments are actually electric guitars.
Yeah, you know, those are fortunately challenges for people much smarter than me. I know that when they said what they wanted to do, there was this like, okay.
aren't you going to die?
And you end up like bringing in experts in certain things, and that's like so far from my end in that I'm the other end of that. Sometimes occasionally I've written like a line of dialogue or that suggests, like I remember years ago when Sam Jackson introduced this tribute to funk, the first lines I wrote were welcome to the church of the eternal funk or something. And the next day I came back in and there was a like stained glass and a church behind it. And I thought, that's amazing. A Jewish guy wrote church and all of a sudden there is one. That's actually kind of how Christianity happened.
Since it was Samuel L. Jackson, I thought he said, welcome to the church of, and you know, messed up that line, but he said the wrong word.
Oh, I know. It was pretty, I remember worrying that it was pretty close, but I think he said it's funk.
Well, two things you can watch when you're watching the show on DVR. One, I felt like the seat holders, the people who sit in a seat while a performer is away or out, I thought they had a lot of attitude this year. They kept catching the camera's eye and peeking over people's shoulder. They really did. I've never noticed it like that before.
And I will look. I've
I kind of noticed that too.
I technically am a seat filler. That's my writer / seat filler, but I'll look out for that.
Yeah. The other thing is the one technical bummer was that the lead into Chick Corea, Stanley Clark, and Kenny Garrett doing Dave Brubeck Take Five, which is one of the great songs of all time, was unfortunately it came in on commercial and they'd already started performing, which is kind of a bummer. I pictured people backstage going shoot, shoot, shoot.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I have to take a look at that. Yeah, I mean, there was never going to be a verbal introduction. That was always going to be sort of a back introduced by Neil Portnow, the head of the Academy. But I'll take a look at all of it. By the way, because I'm going to go on, not to mention another podcast, but Corolla in a few hours. And they want to know what my favorite performance is, but I'd like your opinions. What were name your three favorite performances.
Wow. I would have to go with, well, I love the Preservation Hall Jazz Band, so.
With Black Keys, they rocked it.
Yeah, Black Keys, Dr. John, Preservation Hall Jazz Band. And Dr. John was trying to hide in his costume. I would have to say Bruno Mars. How do you not like that performance? And I'm gonna cheat and do the Lumineers Ho Hey, or Hey Ho, and Jack White.
Oh, yeah, good both. Jack White's was really great, and the funny thing is, this is the only, I can't think of too many like this. The introduction I changed because once I saw the scenario of him first with the women and the men, I figured we'd say, ladies and gentlemen, in that order, Jack White or whatever, and it would be an introduction that would only make sense after you saw the performance. So it's the first time a one-sentence intro is tried to make people think retroactively.
And it worked. I liked that. That was clever. Once he went into his second song, I went, ah, a little light bulb went off in my head.
Yeah,
so,
I was wondering.
Success.
Yeah.
my favorite was the medley, Bruno Mars, Sting, and the Marleys. That was just a terrific performance. I really liked Kelly Clarkson, as I mentioned before. And the only reason I didn't love the Black Keys as much, they rocked the house, but I was bummed that Dr. John didn't get his own thing. But you can't have everyone play every song every year. I understand that. So I will go with the Wait, because you got to hear Mavis Staples and Brittany Howard from Alabama Shakes rock the house.
Oh, that's
on that great song.
And I can tell you that I heard that, like, the verse that Brittany had, she, like, said, because I was talking to T-Bone and some of the other players. I didn't talk to Brittany at the rehearsals, but I think they said, Brittany said, I've been waiting my whole life to sing this verse.
Oh, wow.
This is like her favorite verse of a song, and there she is paying tribute to Levon. And I just loved it because that was, again, that's to me a little bit the Grammy spirit that I like, is that you got Elton John from England, pop, rock, legend. You have T-Bone, sort of quirky genius producer type. You have Mavis Staples, maybe my favorite singer of all time, and just like this definition of sort of church, soul, gospel, church, sort of with a sort of political outlook. And then, you got the Mumford & Sons, who I have to say, of all the groups that have ever been hanging around the Grammys, they have the nicest energy and vibe. They just seem like they're so thankful and appreciative. They literally walked off the stage. When they walked down those stairs, that's where I was standing, and they rushed over to our stage manager, Valdez, and thanked him because he said, you're our lucky man. Because, like, I guess whatever, they literally are so sweet and appreciative. I think they might be too nice for rock and roll.
Yeah, you watch or listen to interviews with them or read interviews with them, and they keep saying, look, we don't know why people like us. We're not that good. We don't play very well. Our songs are, half written, and we're all overweight. So we don't get it.
Or as the New York Times says, the Grammys are out of touch for giving Album of the Year to Mumford & Sons, the best-selling act in the country.
Yeah.
And perhaps the most critically acclaimed at the moment.
A little bit, I think.
Well, now, speaking of being in touch, there was a lot of social media mentioned during the show. I imagine the Grammys want to try and kind of pump that up. But I noticed that the very second Twitter handle mentioned was @WildAboutMusic. Now, you had to have given that to LL Cool J to say.
I was shocked that that happened. No, I was not shocked. What happened, I'll tell you how that, the truth is that, at a certain point, like only maybe 2 days ago, CBS asked what our plans were and sort of promoting on Twitter. And there'd been some communication about it, but it hadn't really gone anywhere. And my feeling was that when you have a host, if you have business like that to do, you want your host to do. If it's his party, he has the authority to, you know, to tell you to do something. It's weird when presenters do that. But I just think LOL is so good. So I tried to think, is there some way to make these fun, you know, not the band fun, but actually entertaining or pleasant. So, yeah, I wrote a joke, which was originally, it's a little bit of a joke, just saying, you know, I'm reading all your tweets, and here's one. Yes, Teenage Girl 1, Taylor Swift does rock. And yes, and to answer the question of typical teen girl 2, that guy, that older guy with Ed Sheeran, is hashtag Sir Elton John. So then CBS Standards and Practices walks over to me and says, hold on, now what address are you going to use? I said, I don't know. And they said, you can't make up one like that because someone could have that, unless you'd have to go and make one. And they said, why don't you just, you could use yours, someone you know. And I actually did tweet the question so that I would not be lying.
nice.
You know, right around that time. But yeah, I also figured, you know, a few hundred million people, maybe I'll get a few followers out of it.
And did you?
I got a few hundred, but I don't know if it was that or the picture of Justin Timberlake I tweeted, which is my favorite picture I tweeted, because I do go back with Justin. I've done a lot of stuff with him. And so I just said, give me a great shot. And I took a picture backstage, and I believe he recreated the Heroes album cover by David Bowie. Or it looks like somewhere between that and Low. It's just this really great arty portrait on a cell phone, iPhone portrait. So I would suggest everyone follow me at Wild About Music, and I'll keep tweeting pictures of Justin Timberlake.
Yeah, you know, and I highly recommend that too. That's where you will find out, of course, your campaign to be the next pontiff. We found out this morning that you're throwing your hat into the
ring. Yeah, I talked to the wife and kids, and they're supporting me in my decision to become pope.
Yeah, that's good.
Well, no, throwing my papal hat in the ring.
Yeah.
I think I have a shot.
Papal.
Papal.
Can't even say it.
I know. It's Babel or Babel. It's, you know, you say Babel, I say Babel.
I did notice that somebody called it Babel yesterday, and I thought, yeah. Uh oh. Well, and also that from now on we're supposed to address you as Sir David, as opposed to just David Wilde.
Yeah, I'm giving myself a lot of names. I think other people give me names, but they're not as nice as the ones I give myself.
Well, now,
and what was your favorite album of the year?
Oh boy.
What album did you play the most?
I played Dwight Yoakam's album a lot. I'm kind of having
Three Pairs. Very good album.
Love that album. I played, you know, I have to give, we should do another music talk. I think my favorite song of the year is a song that I want to make a hit, and I don't know. Maybe you could help me. The Wallflowers, Jacob Dylan. He wrote his best song he ever wrote, called Love is a Country.
Yeah.
Which is my favorite song of the year because it basically sounds like Jacob singing with the Smiths, who I, you know, that's the, to me, that's the band I need to reunite, which I know will never happen, but that's what I want.
Wow. Well, certainly, again, everybody can follow you on @WildAboutMusic. And what do you have that's coming up? Now that the Grammys are over, are you working on anything that we can look forward to?
Yes, I am. I have some liner notes due that I was going to write today. And for Fleetwood Mac, some more. I just did The Rumors, which just came out like last week, a new edition. And I have another one that I have to write like today or tomorrow. And I think I'm pushing it to tomorrow because I am not away. I have to say, increasingly, award shows, especially the good ones, that you feel like you've been through a title match in boxing. I feel like I need to, you know, go to the masseuse and get regenerated. But instead, I'm going to go talk to Adam Carolla and get beaten up over there.
What's the album you're writing liner notes for? The next one?
I don't think I'm supposed to say that, but it is. It is a Fleetwood Mac release that will be available somewhere. But
everyone can look for Tusk.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
It'll be Tusk.
No, it's not. I would kill to write notes for a big Tusk reissue because that is one of my favorite albums of all time. I'll tell you what I would wish. I've openly saying this all the time. I said it in the last few months to Stevie and to Lindsay, you know, Buckingham and Knicks, that I want Buckingham Knicks to come out once and for all officially. And I want to write the notes.
Nice.
That's And if I don't know if you've seen the new Dave Grohl film.
I was just going to say, you know, I saw Dave Grohl kissing your book yesterday, your book with Brad Paisley, Diary of a Player. I saw him, you know, in on your Twitter feed. And it dawned on me when I saw that, I said, well, wait a second. Why can't David Wilde write a companion book to go along with Sound City, which was the studio and, of course, the soundboard there at that studio that Dave Grohl made a documentary about? And that's where Buckingham Nicks recorded their album.
Right, and that's where history sort of changed and where Fleetwood Mac got regenerated. And that movie is, if you have not seen it, it may be my favorite documentary I've ever seen. And it's literally, and my wife, it's like, I feel like it was made for my family because it's got, you know, celebrating Fleetwood Mac, Neil Young, Nirvana, and Rick Springfield, who happens to be my wife's, you know, main obsession, which is why I'm trying to start a Twitter war with him all the time.
And it has much better songs than Showa.
Yes.
And funnier than
yeah,
Showa.
Yeah, much funnier.
That's going to be, I wonder if they put that blurb in the movie, you know, in the paper.
Yeah, funnier. Well, I was dead serious when I said, well, wait a second, you know, it's a great documentary. Why can't David write a book about it?
You know what? I did give him, after I asked him to pose with Brad's book, I did give him my copy. So, maybe he'll think of that. That would be great. I would love that.
Well, we'll have to try and work on that, but we certainly appreciate you taking the time, especially the day after the Grammys, which you helped write, which you wrote. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
No, my pleasure. And thank you for asking.
Well, that was great of David Wilde to stop by. It's always fun to get a little backstage scoop on the Grammy Awards.
Yeah. I mean, I love talking to David Wilde and really definitely follow him on Twitter. He is hilarious. I actually look forward to seeing his posts every single day. And of course, you can also, I believe he also posts with you there, Michael, on the Huffington Post.
He does. He had a pre-Grammy piece there on the Huffington Post. So yeah, you can catch him there as well, where you can catch my stories.
Well, do you have a music story up there?
Oh yeah, we've got a link in the show notes. Every year for the Grammys, I finish my best albums of 2012. I don't get to cover music regularly. I do some features and stories and reviews throughout the year, but I don't cover it the way I'd like to. So I always force myself to do a best albums of the year list tied into the Grammy Awards. And that gives me a little impetus, a little deadline. I can't get it done December 31st. So I catch up with all the other, you know, best of the year lists and fill in the holes that I've been missing and get around to those albums that I've had on the back burner and make sure I get it done before the Grammys happen. And so this year, as always, I posted my best albums of 2012. I had about 70 albums in all. It's officially a top 50. But, you know, I'm pulling from rock and pop and country and rhythm and blues and rap and jazz and gospel and world music and country. So, you know, it's really like five or six albums from every genre. So it's not that many albums when you think about it.
Well, I guess we'll just point people to the Huffington Post and tell them that they can find out all the picks there.
Absolutely.
Although I do think you cheated on number 10, which has four different groups: Mumford and Sons, The Lumineers, Pigpen Theater Company, and the Avett Brothers. That's just my opinion. Maybe you know, we should.
Well, I like to pair people up. I know some people like Mumford and Sons. They obviously know who they are, and some people are catching up with the Lumineers. You know, I want to bring them to their attention. Pigpen, which is this great company. They're a theatrical troupe, actually. A couple guys who were together in college. Now they've moved to New York, and they do these great theatrical shows that involve puppetry and folk tales and great original songs. They just put on these wonderful musical performances, and they're charming shows, about an hour, hour and a half in length. And they did their first show off-Broadway this year called Bremen, and they released their first album because they also tour as a band. They also get together and go around and just play shows. And they're very much like Mumford & Sons of the Lumineers. They're an Americana group. They've got the banjo. They've got great original numbers. And so you might not have heard of them. So I like to pair them up with Mumford and hopefully convince a couple people to try them out.
Well, you know, I just realized I totally forgot to try out all of my Grammy jokes on David Wilde.
Oh, he'll be so disappointed. You would have been, you know, he would have hired you right out the bat. Next year, you'd be writing for the show. What a pity.
I know. I could have told him that, you know, again, that you know, Taylor Swift and I aren't getting back together, like, ever. Okay.
Because really, a joke is better the second time.
It is when you add the little, you know, you see, like, ever, because she kind of says that.
I got it.
Yeah, but, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. It's also
You are ready.
Yeah. I'm beginning to think that you believe my jokes aren't really all that great or a big deal.
Yes. Big whoop. That's what I would say.
Okay. Well, the big deal, big whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. We're going to whip through these today because I know we're running long. Here's our first story. It's about Don Johnson, because another day, another court case in Hollywood, another example of crazy accounting. Don Johnson sued over the drama Nash Bridges a while back because his contract said if the show lasted 66 episodes, he deserved 50% of the show. The show lasted 6 seasons and 122 episodes, exactly twice that amount. But the production company says, yeah, so what? It was really expensive to produce, and they lost about, swizzle sticks, a coffee cup, $40 million on the series.
the worst company ever. Yeah, the show runs 6 years. We lost $40 million. We don't know what's happening.
Now, that joke you laugh at. You know, this case actually went to trial, and Don Johnson won $23 million for his participation in the show and $26 million in interest, because it's always better to get more in interest than you actually earned in principal. On appeal, it was cut down to $15 million. Either side could have appealed, but it ended in January when the company Reicher wired Johnson $19 million. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. By the way, talk about bad accounting. 66 episodes doubled would be 132 episodes. So
that's right.
It was almost double, but still crazy accounting. They have a show that lasts for 122 episodes and they lost money. They don't know what happened. So they're the worst company ever, because obviously Cheech Marin cost a lot of money. He was a co-star on the show. But what I love about this is it's another reason why nobody likes to go to trial. They went to trial and they lost, and their accounting was revealed to be absurd. And so, you know, they don't like to go to trial. This is a good example of why, because they lose.
Well, you know, Michael, I should tell you that, once we're done, if you want me to do your taxes for 2012, let me know.
I wish someone would.
Okay. Well, speaking of finances, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp is planning to split into two separate companies. We've talked about it here on the show before. But right now, it's raking in the dough with quarterly profits more than doubling from $1.06 billion to $2.38 billion in the second fiscal quarter. Hold on, I'm going to do some quick math here to make sure that that is actually double. Harry the one. Yeah, it is. Naturally, they celebrated by immediately doubling the salaries of all News Corp employees below the executive suite. I don't know if that actually happened. But in any case, why the big leap in profits? Credit goes mainly to the moves of their sports franchises in Australia and Asia, with profits increasing by more than $1 billion. The fact that defending itself against lawsuits over its phone hacking scandal dropped some $30 million in costs amounts to a rounding error. Hey, you know what? I'll take a $30 million rounding error. but, you know, it's welcome news nonetheless. We were kidding about them doubling the salary, by the way, of rank-and-file employees. So if you happen to work for News Corp or Fox, you're not going to get a bigger paycheck. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. I mean, that's a massive quarterly jump. Whether that's going to mean they're going to have more value split up, does that call that into question at all? It's going to happen. It's a done deal. But it would make me think twice when things are firing in all cylinders like that to want to mess with success. But I don't know.
Well, since we're on the topic or subject of earnings reports, the troubled conglomerate Sony also saw a huge swing in earnings. It saw a $1.5 billion swing in operating income in the company's third fiscal quarter. Sony marked a $495 million operating profit after losing about $1 billion in the same quarter a year ago. It pointed to a strong movie division led by Skyfall and home video sales for The Amazing Spider-Man and Men in Black 3. Can you believe that? The electronics company is saying that the movie and music divisions are actually making money. Music also contributed, as I just said, to the sales for boy band One Direction, Pink, and Celine Dion, all breaking in the dough. Nonetheless, overall, Sony was in the red for the eighth fiscal quarter in a row and the fourth year in a row overall. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop because nothing has changed much. They're sort of got a little light at the end of the tunnel, I guess, with this this switch around. But still, losing eight fiscal quarters in a row, that's not good news. What was I going to say?
Would it be good news if it was like 9 or 10 fiscal quarters in a row? No? You see, my off-the-cuff jokes apparently are better than my prepared Grammy jokes.
Absolutely.
Okay.
By the way, is this CNBC or is this Showbiz Sandbox? I feel like we've gone into business news weekly, but things could be looking up for Sony. They've got a new PlayStation that's being announced on February 20th.
Rumored.
No, it's not rumored. It's going to be announced on February 20th. There's no doubt about it. It's going to be announced. They are doing a new PlayStation. That's been several years in the making, so that's a chance for them to get back on the bandwagon with hardware. That's where they make a lot of their money. They've also got a weaker yen, so that's helping exports. That's important for Sony. And maybe if they're nice to the Broccolis, that family could make a Bond film every year instead of once every 3 or 4.
Well, apparently Starz is being nice to them because as we went to air, or to, you know, as we pressed record on this episode, Starz, the cable network, the premium cable network, they cut a deal with Sony Pictures to extend their film output deal. Of course, you might recall a while back, a month or two ago, I think it was in December, Netflix came in and scooped up Disney and all of the films coming out of Disney starting in 2016. Of course, that used to belong to Starz, and everybody was wondering, well, gee, what's Sony going to do? Are they going to sign with Netflix exclusively as well? Apparently not. They're signing with Starz.
Did they have to pay a premium? I imagine, you know, Starz was even more over a barrel. They had to get some material. They had to get some films in their library.
I'm sure. And that I don't know. I haven't had a chance to review it.
Well, there you go. Well, I know they've been a partner for a while, so they're now upped through 2021. So for the next 8 years, Starz and Sony are partners together in home entertainment.
Well, let's move on to The Walking Dead, which is the number one show on television, and it continues to be the number one show on television. As far as advertisers are concerned, they only care about people aged 18 to 49, and in that demo, The Walking Dead is bigger than every other comedy, drama, and reality show on TV, network, or cable. The mid-season premiere reached 12.3 million viewers in its debut. Add up all the reruns later that night, and it adds up to about 16.6 million viewers overall. Remember, this is the show that debuted to monster ratings 2 years ago with 5.4 million viewers. If it was still reaching 5.4 million viewers, it would be the number one show on AMC by far, and one of the biggest hits on cable. And it's not even close to being done yet. Keep firing the showrunners, people. That's what we say. Keep firing them. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. It keeps growing. I think the show's been really good this season, creatively. It's been very satisfying. It was a lot of fun last night. My favorite part of the show is when you watch the show and it's been on a break for a few weeks or months.
And they fired the showrunner.
They fired the showrunner. And it says previously on The Walking Dead. And in case you've forgotten what the show's like, there it is. It's mayhem and gore and eye gouging and head crushing. It's like, it was like 3 minutes of the sound of cantaloupes being crushed. It was this glorious thing I've ever seen. I'm like, yep, that's what we missed previously on The Walking Dead.
Wait, were there chainsaws involved?
Probably.
Okay, because I think maybe they're shooting that outside my window right now. Well, look, one of Michael's big picks for a Broadway hit, remember that, was Pump Boys and Dinettes?
Yeah.
Well, it's doing great. The revival of Rogers.
Doing great?
Well,
no, it's not.
Okay. You know, this is the problem with ad-libbing during a read-through.
Yes.
You don't actually know what's coming up next. And
as David Wilde would say, read the script.
That's right. Well, listen. The revival of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella, which is doing great, continues to pack them in. But another one has just collapsed before it even gets going, and that is Pump Boys and Dinettes, the revival that I was just talking about. They just announced it won't be happening. They claim a quote-unquote crowded Broadway landscape, end quote, has caused them to delay, but since there's no new opening date for the fall, that seems like kind of a bad excuse. It did face Annie, a decent hit, kind of, sort of. You know, it might be successful. The Mystery of Edwin Drood, which will close any day now. A road tour of Jekyll and Hyde. Ugh, really? Coming to Broadway for a brief stint? Yeah, like a night. The aforementioned Cinderella and the anticipated revival of Pippin. So it looks like Pump Boys and Dinettes will have to wait for its return to the spotlight. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal for everyone involved. It's one less show on Broadway. And frankly, Broadway doesn't have a very good spring season. So it's a shame. I was really looking forward to this one. The idea that there's too much competition is crazy. They say, I guess they were hoping to win a Best Tony revival of a musical. That would be what they were gunning for. And you could argue, I guess, that Cinderella and Pippin were going to be duking it out for that one. So that Pump Boys probably didn't have a shot at it. But as far as a crowded landscape, well, for God's sake, you know, if you've got a theater, if you've got a Broadway house locked in, it's not that crowded. If you've got a place to do your show, you're all right. And frankly, Annie's not doing that well. That's below 50% of its grosses this week. It's fading, and it's going to get knocked on its ass when Matilda shows
up. Hey, this is a kid show.
Oh, knocked in its tushy.
Okay,
When Matilda shows up. Mamma Mia looks like it's about to close. Chicago looks like it's about to close. Those both have to be. Mary Poppins is shutting down in March. So there's a lot of room to grow for family entertainment. Chicago's not family, but, you know, as far as winning the best Tony revival, you can't depend on that to make box office. You just have to be a good show. And as far as the competition coming out, no, I don't think so. So I don't know what the real story is, but so far we haven't heard about any invisible investors.
Yeah. If you want to know what Michael's talking about, refer to last week's show. The CW Netlit, oh my goodness, they're still a thing? Go figure. Well, they have renewed three TV shows, and their names will shock absolutely nobody. Supernatural, The Vampire Diaries, and Arrow. Arrow, of course, is their biggest hit. Supernatural will be entering its ninth season, and The Vampire Diaries, well, they're vampires. Do we need to say anything more? It will be entering its fifth season. To put this all in perspective, their runaway blockbuster hit is Arrow, which reaches about 3 million viewers a week. On NBC, the Jekyll and Hyde drama, Do No Harm, had the lowest drama ratings in the entire history of the network and was canceled after two episodes. It reached 3 million viewers. So are these renewals a big deal or a big whoop? And I know what we're trying to do here. We're trying to say, look, Do No Harm was a horrible failure at 3 million viewers. Arrow, huge hit on the CW at 3 million viewers. Go figure.
Well, that's how low the bar is for that network.
That's
they would argue that there's a lot more people watching it online and streaming and doing all this other stuff, and they need a new metric to catch that audience. I'm sure more than 3 million people are watching Arrow, but even if it's 6 million people, that's starting to be a decent hit for a cable channel. But for a netlet or a so-called network, it's still not great, and they're in hard times. I mean, their fourth highest rated show is The Carrie Diaries, the prequel to Sex and the City, and it's not even clear they're going to renew it. So that's how much on the ropes they are.
3D TV has always had a chicken and egg problem. People won't buy 3D TVs and all the equipment until there's enough programming to watch. TV networks won't spend the money on 3D programming until there are enough people who own 3D TVs, which can I just predict now will not happen anytime soon? Here's a new wrinkle to the problem. Local TV stations. Major networks are blocked from showing their programming in 3D on a separate channel because that would draw away viewers from local stations. Local stations can't afford to broadcast two channels and can't make the switch yet. This was easier for high def. Local stations could broadcast in high def because the image was still viewable on older sets. That's not the case with 3D. That signal is completely unwatchable on 2D sets and even on 3D sets. I mean, if you wonder why, just take your 3D glasses off during a movie. With this roadblock, it seems almost impossible to move forward on the TV route for 3D. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. I had thought about this. I hadn't heard about it, and it makes a lot of sense. And it, you know, you look at the transition for high def, which worked beautifully. Everybody bought big new televisions. Those channels were being broadcast long before most people could access them, but it didn't matter. Technologically, they were able to do both at the same time, and that doesn't work with 3D for the reasons you've just explained. And frankly, it's kind of a head scratcher. You go, well, gee, what are they going to do? It's not going to work.
You know, The Hollywood Reporter did a major story on live concerts, which has nothing to do with our last story. I've moved on. The focus was on the aging superstar acts. Now, I almost, these words are hard for me to say. With Bruce Springsteen, the Rolling Stones, Madonna, Fleetwood Mac, the Eagles, and Aerosmith, all eligible to be members, not of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but of the AARP. Hard to believe Springsteen's that old. Will they retire someday, and will anyone ever replace them? Concert sales hit a record $4.7 billion, but it's an old story there, too. They sold fewer tickets, but charged more. Never fear, newer acts like Mumford & Sons and Taylor Swift will, by the way, my ex-girlfriend, will likely mature into legacy acts, and plenty of promoters think the future will be dominated by mid-sized venues seating 2,000 to 5,000 people rather than arenas. Thank gosh.
Yeah, that's a good sign. That's a good idea.
Yes. But here was the funnest side that caught our eye. At a Justin Bieber show in Nashville, so many pre-sales were made available via American Express fan clubs, radio giveaways, and industry needs, boy do I know where this is going, that out of 14,000 seats, only a paltry 1,000 were actually available when tickets were officially put on sale to the general public. AEG Live's Randy Phillips acknowledges, I am not sure why we even have public on sales anymore, since most tickets are now sold in credit card, fan club, venue sponsor, and radio pre-sales. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's kind of a big deal that he would admit that, and it's kind of points to the future. Like, why bother? Why annoy and frustrate people? You know, if you're a fan of a person, you better sign up for their fan club, get their email list. They'll let you know when they have a pre-sale. Hopefully, they won't charge you a lot of money to be a part of their fan club or to get access to that. But, you know, you got to have American Express. You got to be part of their fan club. You got to do whatever. It's better than putting them on sale and having like 50 tickets be available to the public, most of which will be snapped up by, you know, bookies. Not bookies, what do I want to say?
Scalpers.
Scalpers. Yeah, those bums. So why annoy and frustrate people?
And for
if you're not going to put tickets on sale, don't pretend to go through the process. And it's frankly, save money.
And
why go through the bother?
I have always said that, okay, make scalping legal or...
No!
Wait,
don't.
Let me finish.
Don't!
Okay, don't make scalping legal, but definitely force these, whether it's the ticket companies or the promoters, to have to publish how many tickets are going to the public on sale. And I think the second you do that, all of a sudden, they're going to look rather foolish when, in instances like this, oh, gee, only 1,000.
Well, they wouldn't feel foolish if they didn't put them on sale.
Well, that's true. So they would just not put them on sale.
It's not that they can't have fan club access or American Express access or have radio stations do giveaways. It's that they should just not pretend to put tickets on sale when it's only going to be 1,000 tickets. But how old were you in 1973, Sperling?
Subtract the... 21.
No.
Oh,
1973. Darn. How old were you?
Okay, I was 2.
You were 2. Are you really shocked that an artist whose first album came out when you were 2 is eligible for the AARP?
No.
I mean, Springsteen came out with his album when you were 2.
Right, and I said at that time, look, this kid is going places.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, that kind of concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. This week, we're going to be talking about a subject I know you like, Michael. It's about reselling digital content. Apparently, Amazon has filed for a patent that will allow you to resell all of your ebooks and all of your MP3s and your iTunes stash. You know, they're trying to make that possible.
That's true. I mean, it's not like you can resell your digital copy of that new John Grisham novel yet.
But no.
The day is coming closer. Amazon filed papers to secure a patent for a system to resell digital copies of books, music, and video. Obviously, they're a long way from allowing vendors to resell used digital copies of Taylor Swift albums and The Dark Knight Rises, but they clearly think that's the wave of the future.
Right. Well, and there's a veracity problem here, because how do you know that the person hasn't, I mean, certainly DRM will help.
But hold on. Let's not get into the technical whatever. It's not a veracity problem. People buy albums on Amazon, and Amazon says, all right, you want to sell it, then make it possible for you. It could be done.
But it's a bit. So how do I know you don't still have a copy of it? Through DRM.
Well, people who are going to steal are not going to bother to fake it in order to sell it again. People who are going to steal copies are going to steal copies. Legitimate users, which is 99% of the people in the country, who buy a book off Amazon, they buy John Grisham, they read it, they don't feel like they need to have a copy on their Kindle for the rest of their life. If they have an easy way to say, hey, I want to sell it, and they get back a buck and maybe can use that towards their next purchase, and they want to do that, they're not there to scam anybody. Most people are not thieves.
So wait a second, you can delete those titles on your Kindle?
Well, Amazon can.
Oh.
Or you can also
that.
Have them stored in the cloud. You know, if you say, I don't need to have a copy of this, well, what's wrong?
I get it now.
It's, what do you mean?
I get what the cloud is all about now.
Oh, So there's perfectly legitimate ways of doing this. It's not it has a technical challenge, but that's why they're patenting it. And one company agrees. It's Redigi. Is that how you say it?
Redigi. Yes, they are trying to let you sell your music, and they're based. I think Boston is where they're out of.
Right. They have a system where they're in Boston, and they have a system where you put it in a locker and then someone else buys it and then they get the digital content and they've removed it from your computer supposedly. And they're, of course, in court battles with various record labels. And they want to expand into books and movies, too. And the head of that company says, quote, the Amazon patent is further proof that the secondary market is the future of the digital space and that there is no turning back.
Wow.
So it does raise a couple issues. Number one,
that is such a loaded comment. Okay, go ahead.
It raises a couple issues. Number one is technical, but it's surely that's not insurmountable.
No, it's not.
If you're on iTunes,
but I will say,
buy an album on iTunes, and then you say, I want to sell it, and iTunes arranges the sale, the next time you sync up to iTunes, they'll just remove it from your thing. And you would say, well, but you could have copied it. Well, sure, of course you could have. But most people are not thieves. It's not a big deal.
But now, let me just say that that is a, you're taking a digital object, a virtual digital object. One is exactly the same as the other. And trying to, in a digital world, place an old world business model across it. It just,
Old world business model to say if you bought something, you get to sell it to someone else. That's not old world. That's normal. I buy a book when I'm done with it. And if I don't need to have a copy of it forever, I can sell it. I used to take it to a bookstore. I should be able to do it digitally as well.
So wait, you
Why
had to
not?
Do something physical with your physical object?
Huh?
You had to do something physical with your book because it's a physical object. And only one copy of that book, your copy, is one copy. And it can't exist anywhere else if it's in your hands. It can't be in somebody else's hands. A digital copy can be in your hands and everybody else's, and it wouldn't matter.
What are you talking about? Just because I have one copy doesn't mean I can make it available free to the entire world. No one's saying because it's digital, all rules change. I bought a copy of John Grisham's book. I don't care if it's a paperback, a hardcover, or an ebook, or an audiobook. I'm done with it. I don't need to store it on my hard drive or store it on my shelf. I want to get rid of it. I have the right to sell it.
But now, do you have the right?
Or give it to my mother, or give it to a friend, or donate to the library, or donate to my local school. That shouldn't end just because we're in a digital realm.
But can
we're
I
not
say
in a world there yet might where be a everybody has access to every album in the history of the world. We're all going to be libraries and all going to be just paying to access. That may happen someday in the future. We're not there yet because they still make me pay money to buy books.
Right. And I would like to say, you say that you have the right to do that, but there is a question about whether you have the right to do that, because are you licensing the book or are you buying the book? Same thing with music. Are you licensing the music as Eminem proved with the Supreme Court? Well, I don't know.
No. He didn't prove that. He proved that the record label can't have it both ways. His record label says, when I buy Eminem's album, I don't own it. I'm just paying for the right to access it. But when they were paying Eminem royalties, they said, oh, no, that was a sale. So that's them trying to be cute. That's what Eminem proved, that the record label can't speak out of both sides of its mouth.
But right. And the courts agreed with Eminem that it is a license. It is a license, not a sale. That's what the court.
But the point is that they got to stick to their contract with Eminem. They can't break it, but they also can't force me to give up my basic rights. I bought Eminem's album. I have the right to resell it. They would claim that's not true. It's going to go to court because that's the second big challenge of this case, of this story. The legal challenges. Every time you buy it, Amazon or iTunes or someone else claims you've licensed it. You haven't really bought it. And that's BS, and it's going to go to court, and they're going to lose. But before Amazon does this, it's going to have to go to court. And that's why the headline on Publishers Weekly, we link to it in our show notes, is kind of a joke. The headline said, Amazon poised to sell used ebooks, as if next week you were going to go to their site and find there was a resale option. And that's not the case. They've just patented something. And now it's going to be a long and winding road before you can actually do that.
Now, do you know what they call that kind of headline?
A teaser, a fraud, a bait and switch?
Clickbait.
It was a headline in an email newsletter that they sent. So I don't know that it's clickbait. It's just misleading. I don't think clickbait is very good when it misleads you and you go to their website and then you get annoyed that they misled you. So I think that's just a stupid headline. That's what I would say.
Okay. Well, we'll see what happens with this patent.
Well, right. And the third point is, should there still be patents?
Oh, my goodness. We're really going to be. Should there still be? You know what? I'm going to agree with Charles Holland Duell. Do you know who he is?
Who?
Yeah, he was the commissioner of the United States Patent and Trademark Office in 1898, and he held that position to 1901, and he kind of was later a judge. But in 1901, in that role, the famous quote that is attributed to him was, "Everything that can be invented has been invented." Now, that's kind of shocking for the head of the patent office to say, but, you know, meanwhile, that's not exactly what he said.
And so you're agreeing with the man who's most famous for being wrong.
Well, I'm...
And you're agreeing with his quote that he's famous for being wrong about.
Yes.
You're saying, I identify with Charles.
Well, I'm trying to move us along to the closing of the show. That's what I was trying
That's
to
right. Well, we've linked in the show notes to an article from the Atlantic Monthly about abolishing the patent. It's an idea that came out from the federal... one of the offices of the attorney general in one of the states, one of the regions in the U.S. It's very interesting. So if you're at all interested in patents and whether it's becoming so onerous when companies can patent the idea of clicking on a button, you know, to buy something, or patent slide to unlock, or hold down to turn off a device. And these are all things that people are trying to patent now. If you think it's becoming so ridiculous that, in fact, it's stifling enterprise and stifling the economy, and maybe instead of trying to reform patents, we should get rid of it, you might want to read that article.
Well, we'll place a link to it in our show notes, along with links to David Wild's Twitter account and his, what else can we place links to some of his books, maybe?
Absolutely.
We'll do that in our show notes on our website, which has links to all of the stories we talked about in today's show. Our website is showbizsandbox.com. That's where you can subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, or Stitcher. Again, we urge you to rate and review the show on any one of those podcast aggregators. Frankly, anywhere podcasts are given away for free, that's where you can find us. You can also follow us. We have a Twitter account ourselves. It is at Showbiz Sandbox on Twitter, and a Facebook page. You can look it up under Showbiz Sandbox. Go figure. All of that information can be found on showbizsandbox.com, along with our email address, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website. What is it this week, Michael?
It's my website is the best album of the year is seasonsofmysoul.com.
Or if you can't find that, or, you know, since, you know, it's so long, maybe you'll misspell one of the words, try michaelgiltz.com. That's always a good bet. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.